Film Spotting SVU is presented by Movies on Demand on cable, bringing the latest indie movies into your home at the touch of a button.
Elizabeth Banks and James Marsden star in Walk of Shame, an outrageous comedy about a night out gone wrong. Watch it on demand now, the same day it hits theaters. Rage premieres on demand May 9th, starring Nicolas Cage as a reformed criminal who enlists the help of his old crew when the Russian mob kidnaps his daughter.
The latest independent films are ready when you are with Movies on Demand on cable. The Art House is now in your house.
From New York City, this is Film Spotting, Streaming Video Unit. I'm Allison Wilmore.
And I'm Matt Singer. On the show this week, Allison and I take a long, bittersweet, cigarette-punctuated look at our podcast relationship and wonder if we can ever escape the tide of history as we discuss Asghar Farhadi's The Past.
Yes, rest in peace, IFC News podcast. Later in the show, we'll bring you Cue Shots, where we recommend some titles you can rent or stream at home right now, all centered on a common theme. In Honor of the Past, which is about a man who returns to the country in which he used to live to finalize his divorce with his ex-wife so she can marry someone new, we were going to dedicate this podcast to the underappreciated cinematic genre of paperwork. However, after three attempts to record an episode resulted in us and everyone in the area falling asleep, we decided it'd be better and safer for everyone to devote the episode to films about marriage instead. But first up is Opening Break, a segment we do in conjunction with our sponsor, Movies on Demand on Cable, in which we spotlight a few notable films new on demand on cable. Matt, what are our picks this week?
Can we just talk more about the scene from Blues Brothers where they try to bring the form all the way up the building and the cops are chasing them and Steven Spielberg plays the guy and he stands... Oh, what a great scene.
It's true. That actually is a great scene.
It's a very exciting scene about paperwork. And how dare you imply that paperwork is boring, Allison?
It's ridiculous.
On behalf of accountants everywhere, I'm offended.
I apologize.
All right. Well, anyway, yeah, we do have some excellent options for some movies on VOD this week. A couple of titles I'm really looking forward to seeing and one I have seen. The first one is one of those titles I'm anticipating. It's called The Double, and it's going to be available on VOD starting on May 9th. It's directed by Richard Ayoade, and it's based on the novel The Double by Dostoevsky. And it is about a guy, played by Jesse Eisenberg, who finds out he has an exact double, played by Jesse Eisenberg. And the cast also includes Mia Wasikowska, Wallace Shawn, and Noah Taylor. The film premiered at the 2013 Toronto International Film Festival alongside another movie about evil doubles, Enemy, which I've already seen and liked. Have you seen either of these movies, Allison?
I've seen The Double and I really, really
liked it. Oh, you did? You really liked it. Is there anything you want to say about it, throw out there right now?
Only that I would say it falls maybe somewhere between, it's got a touch of Eraserhead to it and a touch of Brazil to it. So it's in that realm of film.
How Brazil? Just in terms of like, it's set in like an office mostly and it's a very dysfunctional office.
And in general, it's set in an office where inside the office is maybe low-key Brazil and outside the office is Eraserhead.
Oh boy.
That so maybe sounds... not a great place to live, but a great place to watch.
Right.
Looks great on screen.
Interesting. Yeah. And did you see Enemy or you haven't seen Enemy yet?
I have not seen Enemy yet.
Together, we have each seen one half of the diptych, but I'm looking forward to checking this part out because I've heard, not just from Allison, but from a lot of people, that The Double is really good as well. And Enemy, I didn't think was a perfect film, but very interesting.
Have you spoken to the new employee?
James. Yeah, sure, a minute.
But did you notice anything strange about him? I mean, did he remind you of anyone?
Who did you have in mind?
What'll it be?
I'll just have a Coke.
A Coke. And you?
Scrambled eggs.
And I'll serve breakfast in the evening.
Well, do you still have eggs here?
Yeah.
And do you have a frying pan?
Yeah.
Then give me the damn food. Simon, how come you don't have a girlfriend?
I don't know. There's someone I've been thinking about. I have all these things that I want to say to her. I know what it feels like to be lost and lonely and invisible.
You have to go after what you want.
Do you really think she's looking at me?
Yeah.
All right, now lick your lips.
Yeah.
What? Show the tongue, but be careful not to look like a lizard. Go.
I attract so many weirdos.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to catching up with this half, this evil double of the other evil double movie. And then maybe throwing in Muppets Most Wanted to complete the evil double trifecta, I suppose, since Kermit has an evil double in that one. But this is The Double, and it'll be available on VOD starting on May 9th. Our next pick is already available on VOD. It's called The Sacrament. This is the latest film from director Ty West, who made The House of the Devil and The Innkeepers. This one is based on the infamous Jonestown Massacre of 1978. That's where the famous phrase, you know, drink the Kool-Aid, don't drink the Kool-Aid, the variations thereof, that's where it comes from. This is a found footage horror movie, and it's sort of disguised as a journalistic report from a bunch of guys who work for Vice magazine. And the crew from Vice in this film is played by Kentucker Audley, A.J. Bowen, and Joe Swanberg. And they all go together to this religious commune to visit the sister of one of the characters who lives at this commune. She's played by Amy Simons from Upstream Color, who's also a filmmaker in her own right. A lot of directors acting in this movie. And while they are there filming and visiting this woman, bad things start to happen. And I don't think you need to say much more about that. If you know the incident, you have a vague sense of where the movie is going to be going. This one played at Fantastic Fest last fall. I didn't get a chance to see it there, but I'm a fan of Ty West and looking forward to seeing this one. I like found footage movies, not all of them, but I'm certainly not opposed to them. So it's an interesting combination of subject and form and director for me, and I like that cast as well. Have you seen this one, Allison?
I have not, but I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to checking it out as well. And now we can, because it is available on VOD right now. That's The Sacrament. And finally, last but not least, also available now on VOD, or by the time you hear this, it should be available. May 6th is the date it becomes available on VOD. It's Veronica Mars, the long-awaited film based on the short-lived cult TV series of the same name. This is about the show was about the high school detective played by Kirsten Bell. This is now 10 years later. It's the 10-year high school reunion for the character. And she's reluctantly forced to return to her hometown of Neptune, California, that she's left behind a few years earlier, and drawn back into her old gig of playing detective because one of her friends is accused of a crime and she is the only one who can prove he is innocent. Were you a fan of Veronica Mars, the show?
I liked it. I haven't seen all of it. I saw the first season. I really enjoyed it. And then just kind of, as sometimes happens,
lost track of it.
Yes.
Did you watch the movie yet?
I did not. I kind of felt like I needed to, you know,
catch up
a bit, or at least refresh myself.
Right.
On the
show. I had never watched the show. And I, out of curiosity, just because I thought it was interesting how, you know, this was a very sort of famous Kickstarter. They kickstarted this movie, even though the show is owned by Warner Brothers, and they kickstarted and crowdfunded something like $5.7 million for this movie. And I think then Warner Brothers kicked in some money as well. And so I was sort of just interested in, you know, this show that kind of was a cult hit, never really, you know, found a full audience, but the fans, they stayed faithful and they kept hope alive. And when the chance came to fund a movie, they really came out. And so I was just sort of interested, and I had heard a lot of stuff about, well, it's really for the fans, it is kind of fan service-y, and you need to know what the show was all about to go see it. So I kind of watched it out of curiosity. And the way I sort of put it was, I kind of enjoyed not enjoying it. Like, I didn't really get a lot of it, because it really is something you can just tell watching it, that it's, you really need to know the characters in a lot of cases. And even though the acting is really good, the writing is snappy, and Kristen Bell is fantastic, and you can tell that there's a lot of richness there, like in jokes and characters, and like there's like that high school reunion scene, a lot of it is sort of, I think, just an excuse to kind of shoehorn a lot of the characters from the show back in there, at least for a scene or two, and all that went over my head. But I kind of like that the movie exists, you know, for fans of the show. I think this is great, and I think it's really cool that, you know, something like this could be made 10 years later. And it's not that it's bad. I just realized that it's not really for me. And I think if you were a fan of the show, I would think that you really would enjoy it. So certainly for Veronica Mars fans, if you haven't watched it yet, you should check it out on VOD starting on May 6th.
A horse and carriage, this I tell you, brother, you can't have one without the other. Love and marriage, it's an institute you can't disparage. Ask the local
gentry, and they will say it's elementary. Try.
All right, our topic on Q Shots on this episode, marriage movies, movies about marriage. And this is a little similar to something we've done before. Way back on Film Spotting SVU number 9, we did an episode that was tied to Take This Waltz, the Sarah Polley movie. That was our main review. So tied to that, we did our, I think it was a top five. I think that was a Film Spotting original recipe and Film Spotting's SVU co-joint. So we did our top five infidelity movies in that case. But we figured just marriage movies is enough. Different, because not every marriage movie is about infidelity, that we could do that on this topic. And it's certainly appropriate for The Pass, which is very much about marriage and marriages and all that kind of stuff. Doesn't seem like we have a ton to discuss generally before we begin, Allison.
I feel like there's not enough in common with marriage movies to generalize. Although I would like to give, we're talking about movies in this case, but it did occur to me as we were looking around at different possible, movies to include here, that there is a TV show that has a pretty great marriage that I liked a lot, which is
Married
Friday,
with Children.
Friday Night Lights.
Oh,
yes.
Married with Children has a pretty good marriage in it, too, though. I think you'll admit.
Totally.
Yeah.
It's just like, like everyone's parents, really, who can't relate
Very
to that.
Very powerful.
But Friday Night Lights, the TV show, has a really great marriage in it.
Yes.
And it is streaming on Netflix, so did want to give a shout out to that. But yeah, I don't know that I have any general thoughts on marriage and movies.
I guess the only thing I would say is just the idea that, the romantic comedy, the romantic drama, what have you, is so much about the courtship and so much about all the stuff that leads up to the marriage, even sometimes culminates with a wedding, but very rarely, there's a lot more wedding movies than there are marriage movies, movies that really focus on like the day-to-day life, because that's kind of boring, and I think that's where the movies that I picked go, and a lot of marriage movies go, which is that they're about boredom or about couples that have grown bored. I think that sometimes boring in this light can actually be a positive thing. Pleasantly boring, pleasantly comfortable. But that's not really what these movies go for. That's more like boring. Like, I need to get out. I'm being stifled. I'm unhappy, that sort of thing. But yeah, it's just interesting because that's so many movies are about love and romance, but so few are about marriage.
Yeah. And that's actually in that. The film TV divide. I do wonder if it's a little better suited to TV, just because TV is about returning to people again and again.
The ongoing struggle.
Right. So
it lends itself more to episodic television.
Right. Than to just check in with people for the runtime of a movie.
Right.
It's because usually then it's about trouble in a marriage.
Yes. It's a great point. And because a lot of times, when TV tries to do the opposite, when they try to do the will they, won't they, the romantic thing, a lot of times they string it on as long as they can. And then once they get together on whatever it is, Moonlighting or Friends or something, it's like the show craters or
right.
the ratings go down, or they have to find another thing to make it about, because once they've crossed that threshold, that's like, once the box, Pandora's box is open, you can't put it back in. So yeah, that's an interesting point about film versus television. Yeah, film tends to do the young love thing a little bit better, and television does have
because it's got to keep going.
It's got to keep going.
And then they lived happily ever after.
And, I don't know of how realistic Married with Children was, but that was a show about marriage that went on for years and years and years. And the fact that they were kind of miserable was sort of was one of the jokes. And sort of the longer that show went, it was almost like the more poignant and horrifying the relationship got, because it just became that much more depressing and humorous as a result.
Yeah, a lot of sitcoms actually about people who are married or about like families.
Sure.
Do sometimes have that weird angle of the almost like purgatorial, just because you're like always stuck in that same place. Mm. Always, never, nothing ever changes because it's a sitcom. Nothing's supposed to change.
Right, right. All right, well, but we're not recommending any sitcoms on this episode, I guess. We're gonna
We have not. We're gonna
talk about some movies here. So do you have your first pick? Do you want to begin?
I do. And it's a really sweet depiction of wedded bliss. Rosemary's Baby, which is currently streaming on Netflix. It's Roman Polanski's 1968 film based on Ira Levin's novel of the same name, soon to be seen in TV miniseries form on NBC. And I have to say those promos are not looking very promising to me.
When does that air?
I think it's starting next week.
Oh, that soon.
Yes, and Zoe Saldana,
right, from Avatar?
Yes, I forget who the guy is.
Okay, well, I can look that up while you're talking.
Okay, but yes.
But you're recommending the original movie.
I'm recommending the original. I have not seen any of the miniseries yet, but I'm not
Now's
really
a good time to go check it out, because you'll be thinking about the show and maybe not enjoying it, but...
of course, Mia Farrow plays the Rosemary of the title, a young housewife who moves with her actor husband, Guy, played by John Cassavetes, into an old New York apartment building where they're befriended by the creepy neighbors, played by Ruth Gordon and Sidney Blackmer. And what I really love about the depiction of the marriage in this is the way it slowly sours alongside, you know, Rosemary's pregnancy, her possibly satanic pregnancy, or maybe just her own paranoia and suspicion, you know, that it really gives this sense of a feeling like you no longer know the person you're married to, or that they're slowly slipping away from you. Mm. And it's interesting in that they're so together in the beginning, the two of them. They have this very, like, you know, they move into the new apartment and they're sitting on the empty floor and then they make love. And that kind of contrast with maybe the most famous scene in the movie, in which they have dinner together and he kind of harangues her into eating the chocolate mousse that the neighbors have brought by. And then she has this kind of vision of, you know, this demon being raped by a demon. And I think maybe the most, beyond the fact that it's such a disturbing scene and it's so, like, memorably shot, is that in the morning, the explanation that her husband gives her is that he had sex with her while she was unconscious because they're trying to conceive a baby.
Right.
Which is, like, such a disturbing, normal explanation to give, you know? And I think that just, like, the subtle creepiness of the way that, you know, that John Cassavetes brings to this kind of, as Rosemary herself points out, kind of self-obsessed actor. All actors are a little self-obsessed, you know, she says, that he just kind of becomes more and more sinister. You know, he literally kind of sold her off to potentially better his career. And I think that there's the way the movie tracks that kind of Faustian bargain and just, like, how he starts to seem more and more sinister is fantastic.
What time is it?
It's 10 after 9.
What time did I go to sleep?
You didn't go to sleep. You passed out. From now on, you get cocktails or wine, not cocktails and wine, huh?
The dreams I had.
This movie is, of course, like a masterpiece of paranoia and slow dread and the feeling that you are surrounded by people who are apparently friendly that you can't trust. And the fact that the person who's closest to her is also like that. And the fact that it's worked into their slightly unbalanced relationship, in that she's a housewife and she's home alone while he's off, you know, auditioning for things and kind of supporting them, I think it's just so well done and so creepy and great. And it's Rosemary's Baby. I shouldn't need to sell Rosemary's Baby to you, but, you know, if you haven't revisited it in a while, that aspect, I think, is one that it's easy to overlook in the overall kind of arc of the story, but it's so nicely done. So Rosemary's Baby, currently streaming on Netflix.
All right. And the guy, you know, the husband character in the new show is played by Patrick J. Adams, who I believe is one of the stars of Suits.
Yes. Ah, okay.
And his IMDb page also lists a film upcoming called Car Dogs.
That sounds excellent.
I'm sure that will be equally disturbing as Rosemary's Baby. Car dogs. Are they dogs that turn into cars? Are they cars that are decaled to look like dogs? The Dumb and Dumber, like, van that had looked like a dog?
I should say, the Rosemary's Baby, the miniseries, is directed by a film director, from what I remember. Isn't it Agnetia Holland?
Yes, it is.
So there you go. Maybe I shouldn't be so quick.
You're so quick to poo-poo, Allison.
Oh, my goodness. I apologize.
And you're such a huge fan of Suits. You've seen all 44 episodes.
I've seen some episodes.
And you already pre-bought your tickets to Car Dogs. I don't know why you're such a...
They're in my email right now.
Yeah.
You're right.
Don't just dismiss it.
I apologize to everyone involved.
It could be good. It's probably not going to be as good as the movie, though. I think that's...
I suspect it won't.
That would be surprising if it
outdid the
movie.
All right. What's your pick, Matt?
All right. Well, for my picks, I decided to kind of use this as an excuse to catch up with some... quote-unquote classics, some masterpieces of world cinema that I had never seen, because there's a couple of them that are about this topic. So the first one is called, well, actually both of them have multiple titles. The first one was originally known as Love in the Afternoon and released in the United States as Chloe in the Afternoon. Mm. You can find it as Love in the Afternoon on Hulu Plus. It's from 1972, and it's directed by Eric Rohmer. This is the last of his six moral tales. And it's about a guy named Frederick who is happily married with a wife and a child, and he's got another baby on the way, and seemingly very contented in his life, but all of a sudden everything is kind of thrown into question after this woman, who's not even one of his ex-girlfriends, it's actually an ex-girlfriend of a friend who he didn't even like when they met in the past, wanders back into his life. Her name is Chloe. And she begins to come visit him at his office regularly in the afternoons, or he starts to then visit her, leave his office to go see her. And very soon, this faithful, loyal husband, who's never really considered cheating before, although he has indulged in daydreams and fantasies about women, and we see some of them. We see this one daydream that he has that's mildly disturbing, that involves the use of this like magic amulet where he can control women by this amulet he's wearing. We don't really see anything horrifying with it. That's left to our imagination, but he just sort of engages women on the street while wearing it and kind of talks them into going with him on dates and things like that.
Pourquoi dans la masse des beautés possibles ai-je été sensible à sa beauté? C'est ce que je ne sais plus très bien. Maintenant, quand je vois une femme, je n'arrive plus aussi nettement qu'autrefois à la classer d'emblée dans le clan des élus ou celui des réprouvés. Non seulement je n'ai pas la même sûreté de goût, mais je ne vois plus sur quels critères j'appuyais mon jugement. En quoi consistait ce quelque chose que toute femme, pour m'attirer, devait posséder immanquablement et que je décelais au premier coup d'œil?
All of a sudden, this guy, who, you know, presents himself as this faithful, loyal husband, is suddenly on the verge of infidelity. And I had never seen this movie before, although I had seen its unlikely English language remake, which is called I Think I Love My Wife, which was written and directed by and also starring Chris Rock. So yes, Chris Rock remade an Eric Rohmer film. Apparently he's a big Eric Rohmer fan, according to what I've read. And Chris Rock's movie's not bad. I didn't love it, but it's not terrible. But this is much, much better. The footage of France in the early 1970s, the way that Rohmer films, you know, just like kind of glimpsing people, the way that Frederick looks at people on the train or in his commute, you know, part of what he loves about his life is that even though he is faithful and happily married, you know, he kind of indulges in these fantasies and kind of enjoys glimpsing people on the street. And I just love the way that Rohmer films all that stuff. And, you know, it's narrated by the Frederick character, these scenes. And there's something very poetic about what he's talking about, the way he phrases things, but also very honest, very revealing, you know, that he's kind of, I don't know, just talking about the male psyche and male neuroses and male desires and in ways that I think he's getting at something pretty honest and kind of almost uncomfortably honest at times. And he has some interesting sections just in this early prologue portion with the voiceover when he says things like, "This is why I love the city. People come into view and then vanish. You don't see them grow old. What makes the streets of Paris so fascinating is the constant yet fleeting presence of women whom I'm almost certain never to see again." And as we're hearing this, we're seeing all these images of women and walking through the streets, and it's just fascinating. There's a little bit of, you know, sexuality and nudity in the movie, but not very much. And what really struck me was kind of how, you know, like the less is moreness of this movie. Like, it's a very sexy movie without, you know, there's like a little bit of nudity and almost no sex, but it's a very sexy movie. And like the sexual tension is palpable. And just every time that this character goes to see Chloe or she comes to see him, and just a little peck on the cheek or touching her face or, like, the set, like really the most incredible and sexiest shot in the movie is just this close-up of his hand as he's touching her hip while she's wearing, like, this skin tight outfit or something, but it just like the camera kind of lingers on it in this close up, and you just kind of feel the tension in the air, and just the way that with very little of that, it really kind of builds to this, like, is this guy going to, you know, betray his very sweet, very lovely, very, very pretty, very charming wife? Is he going to, you know, is he going to betray her? And what's going to happen? And there's all this tension. And then the last couple of scenes are so powerful when he gets, you know, when it sort of builds to this, basically the moment of decision, whether or not he's going to do it. And then what happens after that are really kind of devastating. So this one, definitely worth the masterpiece status, the classic status, worth watching. It's Love in the Afternoon, a.k.a. Chloe in the Afternoon. And actually the title, depending on which title it is, I think actually kind of changes how you could interpret the movie. Very, very different depending on the title. But nonetheless, very, very good, whatever it's called. And that's available for streaming on Hulu Plus.
All right. My next pick is from a filmmaker who has done a more recent, very memorable, dark film about marriage called Antichrist, which is currently streaming on Netflix if you want. This is not Antichrist. It is Breaking the Waves, which is available for rent on Amazon and iTunes from Lars von Trier, of course. It's his 1996 film and one that got him a lot of attention. It was the first film of his I saw. And though I have to say, I lean more towards the Lars von Trier of the kind of recent, more outrageous films involving some scary women, including Antichrist and Melancholia. This is of this kind of earlier group of films, including Dancer in the Dark, that have these characters who are essentially martyred. And in this case, the martyr is Emily Watson, who plays Bess McNeil, a kind of an innocent and kind of childlike Scottish woman who marries an oil rig worker named Jan, who is played by Stellan Skarsgård. And they have this very passionate, loving relationship until Bess prays for Jan to come back early from his stint on the oil rig, where, you know, he leaves for weeks and weeks at a time. And he does, because he is injured and returns paralyzed, and no longer able, like impotent and also like barely able to function. And what I kind of like about the increasingly disturbing direction this film takes is that it's two characters who think they're doing the best for one another in this terrible situation, in that Jan feels horrible for having, as he sees it, like trapped her with him when he, you know, is confined to bed, and that his health is terrible and she has to take care of him. And in order to free her, as he sees it, he asks her to go out and take a lover, to go out and have sex with other men, and then come back and tell him about it. She, you know, loves him and will do anything for him. And she's not looking to take more lovers. She's not feeling deprived of anything, but because she believes he needs this, this is what he tells her for, you know, so that she'll really go out and do it. She does do it. And in the middle of her very conservative society, she is ostracized and things go worse and worse for her. But she thinks she is doing this thing that's going to keep Jan alive.
This is unlike you, Bess. Out there, there are people who need Jan and his work. What about them? They don't matter. Nothing else matters. I just want Jan home again. I pray to you. Oh, please, won't you send him home?
There's a potential sadism to this scenario that, and Lars von Trier is not one to skimp on treating his characters sadistically, but that it's softened in this film by the fact that this potentially kind of cruel thing that Jan is asking her to do, I think he's doing entirely because he thinks it's for her own benefit, that he's kind of, rather than consign her to this kind of life without any physical contact, any sex, that he will allow her to have it and will kind of insist that she have it. And then he doesn't kind of realize what he's doing to her. And this film has a great, great leading role by Emily Watson. It was really her breakout. And she's tremendous in this. And the kind of dogma-ish, it wasn't officially dogma, but like dogma-ish style of the film really makes its difficult tale seem both closer and also less, there's no stylized quality to it. You know, it really grounds it and makes something that has this quality of a fable into something more real. So it's a really great film by Lars von Trier, and I think it's probably his most acclaimed. And if you're only maybe more familiar with his more recent, more overtly provocative
redonkulous films,
this one may, you know, come as a pleasant surprise, you know, maybe depending on how you feel about those films.
Pleasant is not necessarily the word I would
use.
Right,
but you know, but like, I mean, this is a film that Nymphomaniac,
yeah, it's different.
It's going to divide people.
Yes, it's very
this
different.
This film was widely acclaimed.
This is true.
You know,
this is true.
As much as rough things happen in it. It's not a pleasant ride, but it is a really good film. Breaking the Waves, available for rent on Amazon and iTunes, and a really kind of sad look at a marriage that starts off with a lot of love.
Mm. Okay, my last pick. It's also available for streaming on Hulu Plus, but I actually would probably recommend people rent this movie on iTunes or Amazon, because for some reason that I can't understand, the version that's on Hulu Plus is actually in Italian. It's an Italian director, but the actors are speaking in English, and so the version that I have on Blu-ray in my house is actually in English, and I'm pretty sure that those rentable versions are in English, and the Criterion Blu-ray doesn't include an Italian version at all. So I'm not really sure why the version that's on Hulu Plus is dubbed into Italian, and you can watch it that way. I actually watched it this way. And then I went back and compared the English version, and you definitely want to watch the English version. But I mean, it's still good in Italian as well. So if you have Hulu and that's the way you want to watch it, go ahead. But just be aware you're getting a Italian dubbed version for some reason. The film is either Journey to Italy or Voyage to Italy. Usually it's called Journey to Italy, but it's known on Hulu as Voyage to Italy, where it's dubbed. I don't understand these multiple titles. This is very confusing. This is the third of Roberto Rossellini's features with actress and also by that point his wife Ingrid Bergman. This one is about a married couple played by Bergman and the British actor George Sanders, and they're on a trip to Naples to sell this beautiful villa that they've inherited from an uncle. And they should be enjoying their trip. I mean, they're in this incredible villa. They've got there's like a staff attending to them. They're in this gorgeous place. They're getting tours and they're being wined and dined. And it seems very lovely, but they seem incredibly unhappy. And mostly they're fighting and arguing and not talking to each other. And all this time that they're spending together on this trip, driving all the way down there and now, you know, having dinners together, it's putting more and more strain on what's clearly a pretty troubled marriage. And eventually, after kind of an argument, they spend a little bit of time apart in Italy, and Sanders goes to like parties and is kind of wandering around trying to meet people, while Ingrid Bergman's character is going to like kind of the local sites. Like she goes to the art museum and looks at art, and she goes to some volcanoes or like this like volcanic pit where there's smoke constantly billowing up, and she's considering all of these ancient ruins and works of art. And I read a few different essays after I finished the movie, you know, because it is a Criterion movie on Blu-ray that just came out recently in a box set with several other Bergman and Rossellini films. And there were a couple of interesting interpretations that I read. Richard Brody has an essay in that book that comes with the box set that's kind of looking at each of the movies as they relate to the private lives or the, you know, of Bergman and Rossellini, and how they had, you know, very famously, she like kind of came over to Italy to make movies with him. They had an affair, they had a child. It was a huge publicity scandal, and they were both married at the time, I believe. And so it was a whole Megillah, as they say. And there's some interesting stuff there, and he talks about that, and he kind of looks at Journey to Italy as, because her character, as we see them, they're these, clearly they're kind of well off, these British this couple, you know, she's wearing this very expensive looking fur and they're living in this villa. And he was kind of reading it as like a movie about Ingrid Bergman, this actress from Hollywood who had been in, you know, was a huge movie star and the trappings of fame and yada, 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 kind of getting back in touch with art, essentially, because she goes to museums and she's looking at classical sculptures. And I thought that was a very interesting reading, but it wasn't really one that I had kind of picked up on myself. What I was really kind of fascinated by in the film was what I saw as kind of this contemplation of permanence and impermanence as it relates to marriage. You know, that marriage is supposedly the sacred vow, and that when you do it, it's supposed to be forever, but it so rarely is. And even if you are married for your entire lifetime, that is such an infinitesimally small amount of time compared to this volcano over here that has been erupting for thousands of years and is still smoking right now. And it's, you know, compared to these works of art that were made thousands of years ago and are still around here today. And there's this really incredible sequence towards the end of the film, and this is not a spoiler at all, but the couple, the married couple, are invited to come look at this kind of ruin that's being excavated from, I think, from Mount Vesuvius. They've like dug up people who have been, they were essentially buried alive in lava, and they've like found the remains, and they're uncovering people who died together, and they're seemingly a couple, a man and a wife, or, you know, and this image of this couple frozen in eternity, like in this lava, is kind of really more than the Bergman character can stand to look at. And it's a really, really incredible scene and raises all these fascinating issues that the movie is about. I wasn't crazy about the ending. And overall, I think I enjoyed Love in the Afternoon a little more than this one. The ending to me felt a little bit rushed and kind of, I don't want to spoil it, but it felt a little bit of a betrayal to me of one of the two characters. I wasn't crazy about it, but everything that came before it I thought was really, really fascinating. The film, you know, reading about it was very influential to the French New Wave. It was not a hit. It was not a successful film. Rossellini was known as a, you know, one of the founders of Italian neorealism, but this film is not neorealist, and that was like considered a betrayal at the time. But some of the French critics who became directors really loved it and were influenced by it.
Look, you can begin to see something.
What is it?
See, looks like a leg. Yes. There's an arm. There are two more legs. Well, it must be a group. Of Menandro, they found the remains of 9 people. There's the head. You can see the skull with the plastic clinging to it. And now the skull bones and the teeth. Both remarkably well preserved. Two people just as they were at the moment they died.
Un uomo e una donna.
A man and a woman.
I had never seen it, and I enjoyed it, even despite that ending that I think is a little, it's a little iffy, but really incredible, and Ingrid Bergman is really, really fantastic in this movie, and some of those scenes are just devastating. That scene with the lava is incredible. So, Voyage or Journey to Italy, available for rent on iTunes and Amazon. And if you don't mind watching the actors speak dubbed into Italian, you can also watch it streaming on Hulu Plus.
Amad, laisse tomber, on va être en retard.
Les billets bouchés.
Oui, bah ça attendra. On doit y être à 9h. Les enfants, dépêchez-vous.
Oh. Oh, Ahmed.
So that brings us to our listener's choice section. Now, we had to make a judgment call on our latest listener's choice poll. The options we gave you were Insidious Chapter 2, David Gordon Green's new film Joe, and The Past from Iranian filmmaker Asghar Farhadi. Joe and The Past were neck and neck the entire week. I happened to be at a screening when the poll closed, and Matt, you were also you also checked that morning.
I checked it about an hour before was the last time I could check it.
Right. And The Past was in the lead.
Right.
But by the afternoon, Joe was winning. So
we but it was only by like 3 votes. I mean, it was unbelievably very, very close.
So we had to get a little interpretive with the democratic process. We decided to go with The Past in part because, as listener Christopher pointed out, while Joe is almost certainly a film worth seeing and talking about, I am not sure it should be an option here, at least at this point, not because it is undeserving, but because it has been talked about already 2 weeks on Film Spotting Original Recipe. So to avoid a direct overlap with our Mothership podcast, we're going to go with The Past, which may have won anyway. We don't know. We apologize for not being present when the poll was supposed to close. So starts our path down the slippery slope towards brutal podcast dictatorship. But in the meantime, The Past, which is available for rent from the usual outlets, is the sixth film from Asghar Farhadi, and it is his follow-up to A Separation, which won the Best Foreign Language Film Oscar in 2011. And The Past feels in some ways like a companion piece to A Separation. A Separation was about an ending marriage and the possibility of leaving Iran. The Past is about a marriage that's already, like, long done and features a character who's left Iran but has since returned. And so it's kind of furthered along this road of two people who have parted. It stars Ali Mostafa as Ahmad, who returns from Iran to France after 4 years to finalize his divorce with Marie, who's played by Berenice Bejo of The Artist. Marie has become involved with a man named Samir, played by Tahar Rahim, who was in the great film A Prophet. He owns a dry cleaner across the street from the pharmacy at which Marie works. Marie and Ahmad never had children, but she has 2 children from her first marriage, the teenage Lucy and the younger Leah. And Samir has a child of his own, a young son named Fuad. He also, more problematically for them, has a wife who's in a coma after an unsuccessful suicide attempt. Now, The Past is a domestic drama, but it's also sort of a mystery in which the incident being reexamined, the wife's suicide attempt and what caused it, seems to become muddier the more that they find, the more information they find out about it. They're kind of looking for closure, and it does not come along easily. The film is also, I think, proof that Farhadi has just one of the best filmmakers working today. I thought this film was terrific, and I'm very curious about why it didn't receive more attention. So I guess that's my question for you, Matt. What do you, like, do you agree that this film is a strong one? And why do you think that it landed without making much of an impact?
I do think it's a strong film. And it's something I've wondered about, too, why it didn't get more attention last year. It's tough, right? Because how do you determine that? Because there's so many good movies at the end of the year. And then there's some movies that are not so good, but they get a lot of attention. Either it's because of a flashy performance, which this movie doesn't really have. It has good performances, but not flashy performances. No one is gaining or losing weight. No one is dying of anything particular. You know, it doesn't have any of the trappings of a important performance. And it's from Sony Classics, who is, you know, it's certainly a part of a large distributor, but, you know, not the most... you know, they're not really known for mounting huge Oscar campaigns. So I don't know. I think maybe it suffered from just, you know, he got a lot of acclaim for his last film, Separation, and rightly so. And this movie is similar in some ways, as you pointed out. It you know, treads similar territory. So perhaps it felt a little familiar to some people. I mean, it's certainly not a remake, and it doesn't even really follow the same storyline. It's really just the same sort of milieu, you know, just a domestic drama with, you know, kind of this, as you said, muddy, unclear situation where people are sort of trying to point fingers and determine who is at fault and kind of assuage their own guilt. That was certainly in A Separation as well, and that's very present in The Past, no pun intended. But they're very different movies in terms of what happens. And, you know, this one is in French.
I wonder if that is also something that in some ways it's more straightforward to put this film that's from an Iranian filmmaker about Iran. And then you know, there seems to be this kind of easy, it's easier to describe, easier, it seems to represent Iran.
You're saying a separation.
Yeah.
Yes,
and
I see what you're saying.
Traveling, it creates more of this sense of cultural confusion, as much as like I feel like it presents this very interesting vision of suburban France.
Sure.
And also like immigrant France that I don't think you see very often.
I think another way to look at it would be to say that a separation had a hook, essentially, right? It was showing us something we haven't seen a lot of, which was sort of like the inner workings of Iran and
the class system.
The class system and also
like
the judicial system.
Yeah.
Like the way the courts work in that film is fascinating. And it's not something I knew anything about. And I presume a lot of people watching this, especially in America, had no idea about. And so you have a really interesting domestic drama, one. But then the hook is, but it all takes place in Iran and you don't really know this stuff and you're learning all these kind of fascinating details about their lives and their system and their way of government. And so that was all kind of maybe an extra hook to get people in the theater, or when you're just telling someone word of mouth wise. This movie doesn't have any of that. You know, it doesn't really have any kind of like, oh, you're going to see what, you know, the judicial system in France is like. Well, you don't see it at all. And even if you did, you probably wouldn't be that interested because it's not all that interesting or different or exciting. So maybe that was another reason. But I don't know. I've wondered about it too. I think it's just all these reasons that we've said. It just, you know, it doesn't have the kind of things to make it stand out in an Oscar campaign, an Oscar season, when there's so many movies vying for attention.
Yeah, it does. I feel like something that it does so well that I noticed this in A Separation as well, is that it allows, without having any overt exposition or
yes.
characters delivering that, allows information about characters to be revealed so well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I feel like by halfway through the film, as it is introduced, these multiple, you know, like two exes, children from different marriages, secrets and all of that, that you could kind of explain how each pairing of characters felt about one another in a way that I thought was so unusual
mm-hmm.
for a film, you know, without having to kind of be like, here and here's what's happened. It kind of allows information to leak out so elegantly.
Yes, I would agree with that. And I would say also what I felt even more, and I had seen the film once before, this was the second time I watched it, was, you know, now that I knew exactly what was going to happen in terms of the story and paying just a little bit less attention to that, I was really just kind of struck by, similar to what you're saying, how well he communicates those kind of ideas and that information visually. And it's not the kind of like, you know, fancy schmancy, you know, incredibly wild shots. That's not what we're talking about here. What we're talking about is just smart use of camera and imagery. You know, the opening shot of this movie is the husband character returning to France, the soon-to-be ex-wife waiting for him at the airport, and they're separated by this glass wall, and like they're kind of talking to one another or trying to communicate, but they can't communicate through this barrier, and they literally haven't said anything to one another that we can hear because it's through this glass wall. But without any dialogue at all, we immediately understand some of this relationship, and we get in this one very simple but very effective image, this couple is divided. They're being, you know, they're split up by this invisible but very present barrier that is somehow keeping them apart and is preventing communication, essentially.
Yeah, and that image of like people kind of being separated by glass
comes up over and over.
Yeah, is a recurring one
yes.
through the film, right through the kind of final image.
The final shot of the film is similar.
Yeah, and very and beautiful.
Very powerful.
Yeah, it's
yes.
very powerful.
And yeah, and they're not even just, you know, there's a lot of windows in general in the film, and like looking at people from one side of a glass window so you can't hear them on the other side. But there's also things like, I was watching it this time, I was even like, you know, because the Tahar Rahim character, the sort of the new guy that she wants, that Bernice Bejo wants to marry, he works at a dry cleaning business, which involves a lot of plastic, clear plastic, and covering clothes in these like bags and semi-like permeable bags and stuff. And again, a similar image of like, you know, seeing someone but still being separated from them somehow by plastic, by glass, whatever it is. And I thought, again, another choice that kind of connects those two things just beautifully. And, you know, he could have been any job at all, but he, you know, I mean, the job eventually comes into play in the plot. But I think I really wonder if that was part of it, is he loved that image, because he's introduced, actually, that character is introduced from behind, like, the stand where they put the plastic over the clothes. He's, like, behind it, and then he kind of steps out from in front of, and into in front of it. And just the way he's introduced that way, similar to the other character, Ahmad, being introduced behind glass, I was like, it's can't be a coincidence. It's definitely the work of a deliberate and very intelligent visual filmmaker.
Yeah, and without ever, as you said, being flashy, like, there is nothing about this film that is flashy.
No.
Which, you know, maybe to its detriment in terms of, like, alluring audiences.
Maybe.
But I think it is so subtly well made. It's,
yes,
it's kind of amazing.
But again, it's like what you were saying. He's able to communicate all these ideas visually without saying them. He just finds these things, but he doesn't make them so heavy handed that you're, oh my god, he's doing this
right.
again.
The bird stands for this. There's
right.
never any moment of, like, overt
right.
symbolism in that.
But
way,
just yeah. things like it actually comes up more than once. There's a scene that involves the faucet, the sink in the kitchen, which is, like, stopped up. It's clogged, and Ahmad fixes it and gets rid of the clog, and then all of a sudden the water is pouring out. And where this is in the film is sort of at this point where all the characters have kind of been, like, stopped up and, like, kind of burying their feelings. And this is right at the point where everything is about to come rushing out. And it's sort of this idea that now that Ahmad has arrived and people are talking about the situation involving the wife and the coma and the child and all this sort of stuff, that now everything is coming rushing out. And again, they don't make a big deal out of it. It almost seems like just a piece of business that's going on in this scene, but you really realize that nothing is like that in this movie. There are moments, you know, littered throughout it where he is doing that to this very purpose, and it's really brilliant. There's another great one involving a Band-Aid. I don't know if you caught that, but near the end of the film, there's a scene between Tahar Rahim's character and his son. And he's like, the son is in the bathtub and they're talking, and this is after another big emotional moment in the film, and he pulls off a Band-Aid that the son got earlier in the film after he cut his finger, and it's almost this idea of, like, the wound has healed kind of a thing. And just like, again, they don't dwell on it, there's no close-up, but it's there. And
yeah.
It's that stuff that really makes this movie really lovely.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and the house itself, Marie has this house that's in the middle of being renovated. And
right.
there's that whole idea of all of these relationships that are kind of stuck in this halfway point. Even the house itself that they're living in is, like,
it needs repair. Being transformed.
You know, it's not the home it's going to be.
Right.
Eventually. It's kind of up in the air. It's this transitional place. And that fits so well with these multiple themes of relationships that are kind of caught. You have, obviously, this former relationship with Ahmad that he's coming to provide, official closure for.
Mm-hmm.
But provides, in the end, no real kind of emotional closure for, you know, and the film suggests in a very nice way that, like, looking for that kind of closure is maybe a kind of foolhardy process.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the relationship with Samir, in which the wife is, like, a literal symbol of, like, his past relationship that, like, you know, in if she were alive, that he could have left her.
Right.
If she were dead, then
he could,
you know,
just move on.
He could move on. But instead, she's caught in
right.
this point between life and death, and they are, like, literally just suspended, like, not really, you know, like, even if they were to get married or want to get married, they might not be able to because
right.
his wife is still alive and in this coma. And the film deals with these themes so well without ever kind of leaning on them in a way that I thought was amazing. What did you think of the child actors here? I thought Fouad was particularly amazing.
He was fantastic, right?
Yeah,
he hadn't acted before.
Yeah, he only has one credit. He's like, to a point where you forget that he's an actor.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I actually have him in my notes as I just have a little note saying the boy who played Fouad was fantastic. And he is. He's incredible. I mean, it's one of those child performances that, like you said, it doesn't feel like a performance at all. It really feels like it's like a documentary or something. It just feels like this, that they've captured a little piece of this little kid's life. And Yeah, I don't know who he is, where he's from, what his real life is like, where he drew this performance from, how they drew it out of him.
That's like it. There's a scene really early on when Ahmad first arrives where he basically throws a tantrum. Mm. And just watching it, I wonder, like, how do you direct that? Because it's like a real child tantrum of like a violent one, you know, and like, it's just like, how do you end up capturing that and instructing a kid in that? It's amazing.
And having it feel genuine. And he does some really subtle stuff too. It's not just all yelling. I mean, there's a lot of scenes where it's a lot about his body language and him looking down at the ground and feeling ashamed of what he's done. There's a lot of times where his father is telling him to look at someone or, you know, shoving his head up with it, you know, kind of nudging him and stuff. And just all of that little subtle work is incredible too. I mean, yeah, he's this incredible young actor and you go, where did this kid come from? And what an incredible performance he gives. It might be the best in the entire movie, actually.
And there are some very strong ones, but like he is something else.
Yeah.
Like really, it stands out. Yeah.
Any other things we haven't touched on?
No, I think other than that, I recommend this film highly. It's a pretty great one.
Did you like it more than A Separation?
No.
No.
A Separation, I think, is going to be one of the best movies of this decade.
Mm.
And it was one I adored. But, like, I think this one is a slightly tougher sell in terms of it describing it.
Right.
And I think it is really worth looking up.
All right. So for people who haven't had a chance to see it yet, there you go. That's your recommendation. Give it, if it seems a little dry or it doesn't seem as enticing, it's worth a look.
A Separation was something, if you described it, that said, wow, that sounds sexy. Like, you know, two people try and get a divorce while trying to figure out what to do with one of their aging parents in Iran.
I'm sold. Here's my $15. No, I understand what you're saying. But it's a good movie. So people should check it out. That's The Past, and it's available now for rent on Amazon, iTunes, Google Play, all over the place.
And that brings us to our Behind the Eight Ball section, where every episode we bring you three picks that are new to streaming, two that are recommended by our listeners, and one that was randomly chosen from our Netflix My List. Matt, you're up first. Are you ready?
Yes.
All right. Three new picks.
Okay. First up, if you're looking to set the mood for the new Godzilla movie that's coming out in a few weeks, you should check out a bunch of Godzilla movies that were just added to Netflix. There's a whole slew of old Toho Godzilla movies that are on there now. You can watch Godzilla King of the Monsters. There's Godzilla Raids Again, Godzilla vs. Monster Zero, and Godzilla's Revenge. Allison, Godzilla's Revenge, that's a really interesting one. That's the one where, have you seen that one?
I have not.
Godzilla, he goes on a rampage. What happens is, like, these people kill his wife, Rachel Godzilla, and then he swears revenge. he's like a liberal guy who never thought he would. It's really good. You should check it out.
Godzilla's
Revenge.
Yeah.
The one that I'm going to recommend besides that one is called Godzilla vs. Mothra. And in this one, a troublemaking Godzilla returns to wreak more havoc around Tokyo. And meanwhile, a couple of brave journalists, they travel to an island populated by Mothra worshippers to recruit the giant insect to defend Japan from the giant dinosaur. First third's a little bit sluggish, but I enjoyed how hallucinogenic this one is. There are these two tiny twin women who wear a lot of egg-related clothing and sing to Mothra. There are giant Mothra larvae that shoot, like, webs out of their mouths. It's very weird looking. And the fights are really good. And I even like the Godzilla suit in this one. They gave Godzilla these, like, angry furrowed eyebrows, so he looks like a total a-hole. It's really, really fun. So that's Godzilla vs. Mothra, available on Netflix. And again, if you're looking for more Godzilla action, that's all up on Netflix now, so take a look. My second pick is another classic, almost as classic as Godzilla vs. Mothra. It's the Frank Capra film Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. And this is something I was actually excited to see pop up because I'm going to be writing about the film in a few weeks for The Dissolve. It's going to be a movie of the week on the website. We do that every week. We pick a classic film and talk about it. And my next pick was Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, which I got the disc of. But as luck would have it, it was just added to Netflix. And this is a fascinating film with James Stewart as Jefferson Smith. He's a idealistic, like, Boy Scout leader. He's chosen to replace this senator who's died because the assumption is because he's this idealistic, naive guy, he'll be easily controllable. And Jean Arthur is the co-star. She plays his secretary. He's very cynical, but she kind of falls in love with his idealism as she helps him navigate the Senate. And it's a fascinating film. I remember what really made me interested to go back and watch this was watching the second season of House of Cards. And I can't remember if we discussed this in our discussion of it, but there's an episode of House of Cards in the second season that kind of plays like the evil version of Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, where the character played by Kevin Spacey is in the Senate kind of doing all these kind of machinations. And it almost – I found it fascinating to compare that to Mr. Smith. So if you've seen House of Cards, if you enjoyed that episode I'm talking about, or even if you haven't, it's an interesting time to go back and look at Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, now available on Netflix. And finally, another one on Netflix. This is a movie I haven't revisited, but when I saw that it popped up, it made me go, God, I enjoyed this movie a long time ago, and I haven't seen it in so long, and I need to revisit it. So I added it to my list, and I'm looking forward to a day when I don't have much to do and I can take a look at it again. It's Sneakers, the 1992 heist film with one of the all-time great casts, Robert Redford, Dan Aykroyd, Ben Kingsley, Mary McDonald, River Phoenix, Sidney Poitier, and David Strathairn. It's about a bunch of computer experts. They're recruited by the NSA to snag this MacGuffin and yada, yada, yada. I don't really want to spoil any of the twists or what happens, but it's a really fun movie, good performances, great twisty plot. And do you like Sneakers? I feel like it's a movie that didn't really do much at the time, but it's kind of slowly people realize, like over time, it's taken on this reputation as just a very entertaining movie.
Yeah, I mean, I do, but it's been so long since I've seen
it. Yeah, it's been at least a decade since I saw it, so I'm looking forward to revisiting
that's
it.
That's one that I've added to your as well.
Your my list?
My list, yes.
All right, so that's Sneakers, available on Netflix.
All right, two listener recommendations.
Okay, my first one here is from Jill M. She says, we've been watching The Rockford Files. It's probably more fun if you're old like me and can remember crappy old Los Angeles, but still very fun. I've never watched The Rockford Files, Allison.
I have not
either. And it was James Garner, and I believe he plays a guy named Rockford Files, and he is the Rockford Files. No, I think he's a detective, and he's named Rockford, and there's files somehow. But it's supposed to be a good, you know, classic TV show, but I've just never watched it. I saw that it popped up on Netflix recently and was going, oh, I should watch some of that. I bet I would dig it. So on Jill's recommendation, I have added that to my list as well. Our next recommendation is another one from – we've been getting some from, like, internationally, more internationally lately than nationally, frankly, which is really cool. We have – this one is from – a listener named Mitchell in Wellington, New Zealand. We're really big in New Zealand now, Allison.
I love it.
I love it too, yeah. So this letter begins, Dear Allison and Matt and fellow Sfoovers, I was overjoyed to hear that you would be reviewing the Alan Partridge movie, as well as providing some recommendations on British comedy, also having just rewatched The Office Christmas specials, and a few episodes of Knowing Me, Knowing You this week. Your podcast could not have been better timed. However, my joy was replaced by cringing embarrassment when one of your first recommendations was the Carry On films. Please, 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 film spotting listeners, carry on listening to film spotting, but avoid these films like The Plague. They are as representative of the quality of British comedy as Everybody Loves Raymond is to American comedy. I liked it. What did I say? I enjoyed it. I watched it.
Also,
liked it.
I hate to tell you, but Everybody Loves Raymond was a hugely successful show.
Yeah.
So we can't shrug it off.
Yes. Living in New Zealand, Mitchell writes, we are blessed with the option of choosing between some of the best viewing options in the U.S. and the U.K. and our neighbors, the Australians. Also, our content, like Flight of the Conchords, isn't too shabby, too. I thought I'd recommend some other British comedies that aim higher than the Carry On catalog, all of which are available on Hulu. And I looked to see where these were available in the U.S. So here's very quickly Mitchell's recommendations. Spaced. If you enjoy the Cornetto trilogy, Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, and The World's End, then Spaced is absolutely essential viewing, starring Simon Pegg and Nick Frost under the direction of Edgar Wright. That is indeed available on Hulu Plus. Peep Show, filmed using a first-person POV. The best feature of this show is the hilariously awkward internal dialogue that underscores the actions of the two main characters, Jeremy and Mark, possibly the most neurotic character ever created for television. That's available on Netflix and Hulu Plus, both in the U.S. And finally, Mitchell writes, I'd also recommend Derek, Ricky Gervais's far superior follow-up to Life's Too Short. And that is also available on Netflix. I haven't watched that one yet.
I will say, Mitchell, I like your first two recommendations a lot.
Uh-oh.
Love Spaced. Love Peep Show. I'm not with you on Derek.
Oh.
I really do.
Carry on
Derek.
Not watching Derek. All right.
It's coming back for a second season, though.
Okay.
Yes, that I think is going to be on Netflix.
That's all right. We can have some differences here. But nonetheless, those are the recommendations here. Space, Peep Show, and Derek on Hulu Plus, Netflix and Hulu Plus, and Netflix respectively. And that was all from Mitchell in Wellington, New Zealand. Thank you for the email.
Yes, thank you. All right, one from your My List.
Okay, you gave me number 11, which this time is Simon Killer. This is the film directed by Antonio Campos, who made the film, I believe, After School.
Yes.
Which I thought was an excellent film.
Yes, it was.
And I have not had a chance to watch this one. This was his follow-up to it. Didn't get as good reviews as After School. Haven't had a chance to catch up with it, but I have it on my list. And the description from Netflix is, young and heartbroken, a New Yorker travels to Paris to escape his romantic woes, but is soon drawn into another all-consuming attraction. And the star is Brady Corbett, who I think I know best from the U.S. version of Funny Games, right? Isn't he in that?
Yes.
Yes, I was right. So yeah, so I know him from that. He's a good actor, actually, and I definitely am interested in checking it out. I just missed it the first time around, and it wound up on the list. And hopefully, I'll get the chance to watch that sometime in the near future. Allison, are you ready for your list? Your countdown?
I am ready.
All right, three new titles.
Okay, first up is a film that was given the unfortunate title of Karaoke Terror in the U.S. It is currently streaming on Hulu. The Japanese title, I think, as far as it's translated, is a little better. The Complete Japanese Showa Songbook is directed by Tetsuya Shinohara. And it's the story of an escalatingly and eventually absurdly violent war between two groups of karaoke lovers.
I'm intrigued.
Yes.
I'm officially intrigued.
One is a group of disaffected, kind of bored 20-something guys who live for these elaborate... Both of these groups sing like kind of 60s, 70s schmaltzy songs from Japan, the Showa period.
Hitting a very deep chord in me already.
So the 20-something guys and this group of older divorcees who are all named Midori. So they're the Midoris. And after one from one group kills the other, they begin to fall into this war. And it's a really dark comedy and eventually a really absurd one. But if you love karaoke and you love people violently killing each other, this is the film for you.
Wow.
It is currently streaming on Hulu.
Crap, I gotta see
also this. Also new to Hulu is Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence. This is Nagisa Oshima's very strange and really interesting 1983 film about prisoners of war, starring David Bowie as Major Jack Selliers and Ryuichi Sakamoto as Captain Yonoi, who is the Japanese commander of the camp in which he's stationed and who becomes kind of fixated on him. It's a story about kind of clashing cultures and failures of communication and kind of different ideas of masculinity and heroism and also possibly repressed homoerotic fixation. And also Takeshi Kitano is in it, playing the kind of role he plays so well, which is a guy who's kind of cheery and also capable of horrific violence. And, you know, Oshima, of course, did In the Realm of the Senses. And this film also has like a bit of that really dark line between, I would say, like affection and love and cruelty in it, all in this World War II setting. Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, currently streaming on Hulu. Oh. And finally, new to Netflix, Maximum Overdrive, 1986 film that is Stephen King's lone directorial effort based on his own short story, Trucks. You could be generous and call it a curiosity. It was...
You have seen it?
I've seen some of it.
You've seen some of it.
It's not a good film, but it's definitely unique. Stephen King himself in an interview book said that he was coked out of his mind throughout this production for what it's worth. I also highly recommend
the trailer
featuring King, which is on YouTube.
I've never seen the movie, but right the trailer now is amazing. And it's actually features Stephen King.
He is.
Maybe he was coked out of his mind.
It's certainly believable that when you watch this trailer.
Right. He's talking directly to the camera and vowing to scare you with his movie.
Yes.
Maybe we'll play a clip of it right here.
Hi. My name is Stephen King. I've written several motion pictures, but I want to tell you about a movie called Maximum Overdrive, which is the first one I've directed.
Wow. What in the dickens is going on around here?
A lot of people have directed Stephen King novels and stories, and I finally decided if you want something done right, you ought to do it yourself.
And who was driving it?
I don't know.
Curtis! It's coming after us!
It was my first picture as a director. And you know something? I sort of enjoyed it.
Okay,
there
yeah.
There you go.
I'm yes. terrified right now.
Soundtrack by AC/DC, starring Emilio Estevez, in a story about how all of our machines and electronics come to life and try to kill us, including automobiles, but also killer soda machines and arcade games. How could you
some
turn
scary
that,
stuff,
how
guys.
Could you turn that down? Maximum Overdrive, currently streaming on Netflix.
Cocaine is a hell of a drug. All right, how about two listener recommendations?
All right, first up is a recommendation from Genevieve, who writes, I just wanted to recommend The Hour, an underseen British TV series, which is written by Abby Morgan, who wrote Shame, The Invisible Woman, and The Iron Lady. It centers around the production of a fictional BBC news program called The Hour in the 1950s. The protagonist, Belle Rowley, played by Romola Garai, is a young woman, and when she is placed in charge of this news program, it ruffles some feathers. She has to juggle demands from her bosses as well as the staff working on the news program. When this series premiered in 2011, it was compared to Mad Men because of the time period. However, I think it's quite a different beast by its tone, rhythm, and focus on British politics. The first season also has an important spy thriller element to it, though I like the second season even more, which toned down that thriller element and spent more time focused on its core characters. It's really those characters and their relationship that I found fascinating. The acting is fabulous. In addition to Garai, the cast is comprised of Ben Whishaw, Dominic West, Anna Chancellor, and Peter Capaldi joined in the second season, and he's fantastic. It's quite easy to catch up on the show since there are only two seasons of 6 episodes each, and sadly for those of us who loved it, there will not be a third season since it was cancelled by the BBC a few months ago. Still, it's absolutely worth the watch. In Canada, it's streaming on Netflix and available for purchase in iTunes. I should note that in the US, it is available on Amazon Prime Instant Video. And she also writes, it's worth tracking down in HD because the cinematography is beautiful. So that is The Hour, which you can find in the US on Amazon Prime Instant Video. And we have a recommendation from Lauren, who writes, last night I scrolled through Netflix for the millionth time. I stumbled upon the documentary Milius about the infamous writer and director. Obviously, I'd heard of John Milius and his resume, Apocalypse Now, Conan the Barbarian, Red Dawn, but I really didn't know much beyond that. I found the documentary incredibly compelling. It's really something to watch revered directors like Spielberg, Coppola, Scorsese, and Lucas, who all came up with Milius, talk about him. It's always fascinating to see directors you love discuss something or someone they're really fond of. I had heard the story of how Milius turned in a 10-page monologue about the USS Indianapolis into a stuck Spielberg while he was working on Jaws. And while that story is a testament to his great talent as a writer, and as Spielberg puts it in the doc, a raconteur, it's just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to mythic, many of which are not necessarily complimentary Milius tales. Overall, I'd say it's a must-see for any film fan, and while the doc is populated largely by colleagues who love and respect John Milius, it doesn't always shy away from showing the more troubling aspects of his personality that made it hard for him to blaze a trail the way his contemporaries did. It's a highly engaging documentary worth watching for sure. So there you go. That is on Netflix.
That's a good one. I've seen that movie. It's definitely that's a good pick. Okay, and one film from your my list.
You gave me number 32, which is actually a film I added on your recommendation. It's In the House, the Francois Ozon film starring Kristin Scott Thomas, which you said was great
and
an underappreciated film. And so
why is it so far down there, Allison?
Because when you add new ones, it bumps them down.
Should be way higher. Well, I'm ashamed of you. How dare you? It's
I
like spitting
again.
On my recommendation.
All I do this time is apologize.
Why don't you just take my recommendation,
world.
Crumple it up, and throw it right in the
sorry,
trash? Why don't you
world.
Just do that? Ah, unbelievable. Unbelievable. All right. Well, should we get to our picks for our next episode, our listener's choice options?
Let's please.
Well, you, Allison, found a few 80s movies that were newly added, and you thought that would make for an interesting theme for our next episode, at least for the listener's choice options, 80s movies. So I think you have the first one here. What is it?
Yes. Well, I tried to do a mix of, I feel like out of all of these, maybe one is the one that's more looked at for nostalgic reasons than it is for as a film itself.
Mm-hmm.
But the first two, I think, are kind of standalone. The first one is The Big Chill, which is new to Netflix. It's Lawrence Kasdan's 1983 dramedy about a group of college friends, among them Glenn Close, Jeff Goldblum, William Hurt, Kevin Kline, and Jo Beth Williams, who reunite after the suicide of one of their friends. And what I think is so interesting about this is that the Big Chill format is becoming one that people try and revisit and remake. You know, this was tried to be a film about a generation, about like this baby boomer generation. And that already this year, there have been two films that have tried to be the Big Chill of our moment. One, Goodbye World, which kind of combined the Big Chill with the possible apocalypse. And there's one at the Tribeca Film Festival called About Alex that involved a lot of TV stars, including Aubrey Plaza and Schmidt from New Girl and others, as in the exact same format, basically, except that the main character, or the character who is in the title, did not die in a suicide attempt. He survived, and they all come to visit him. But the fact that this has become something that people revisit to try and encapsulate the way we live now, I think makes looking back at this one worth doing.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's going to be a Criterion Collection film in a few months.
I did not know that.
Yes,
well,
it was recently selected. Has not out yet.
Yeah.
I'm not sure which month the Blu-ray comes out. But yes, just selected. It was like their last wave of announcements. That was one of the titles, the big Chill. So it's a modern classic now, Allison.
There
you go.
Criterion says so.
Yes,
got it
exactly. So that would be interesting. I've never seen that movie, and for all the reasons you said, and I said, I definitely would be interested in checking that one out. Our next option, also available on Netflix. This one I have seen a couple times. It's called Say Anything, and the reason we thought to do this one, besides the 80s thing, is that this film just recently celebrated its 25th anniversary. So it's a good time to look back at this iconic teen romance from 1989, written and directed by Cameron Crowe, of course, starring John Cusack and Ione Skye. And really, how often, Allison, do we have the chance to review a movie while we both hold boomboxes in the air?
I better start working out, though. That's a lot of time to be holding
20
something.
Minutes holding it in the air? You don't think you could do it?
I just really don't have a lot of upper body strength.
I think if Peter Gabriel was egging you on, you'd find a way.
I hope so.
He has a way of inspiring people. So, yeah, that's option number two, Say Anything, available on Netflix.
And finally, and these are all on Netflix, this last one is also new to Netflix, St. Elmo's Fire, which I would say of the three is probably the one that, as I said, is most
awesome.
An artifact of its moment. Also, okay. We've had Say Anything is high school. The Big Chill is like years after college. St. Elmo's Fire is directly after college.
We're covering our bases.
Yeah, it's about a group of recent graduates from Georgetown University who are kind of doing the thing that even in the 80s people did after graduating, which is to kind of wander around, not really sure how to start their adult lives, and has the most Brat Packy of Brat Pack casts, including Emilio Estevez, Rob Lowe, Andrew McCarthy, Demi Moore, Judd Nelson, Ali Sheedy, and Mayor Winningham. Amazing. And also directed by Joel Schumacher, which I did not remember. But it's a 1985 film, peak of the 80s. And certainly, regardless of whether it holds up, I think it's probably interesting as a look at the 80s. The 80s.
Oh, you're done? Okay, sorry. Okay, so which movie should we review on the next episode of Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit? You can send your pick to SVU at filmspottingsvu.com, or you can enter in the poll on the right-hand side of the page at filmspottingsvu.com. Your vote must be received by Monday, May 12th at noon. After that, we'll announce the winner on our Twitter account, @FilmSpottingSVU. And you'll have all that week to watch the film and then join us for our conversation on our next episode on or around Tuesday, May 20th.
FilmSpottingSVU.com is also where you can find our show archive, as well as a list of direct links to all the movies and TV shows we discuss on the show. The Film Spotting SVU remixed theme song is by Vince Vandal. You can listen to more of Vince's work at vincevandal.com. And we'll be back in 2 weeks with more movie recommendations and the review that you pick. And in the meantime, you can follow us on Twitter @AllisonWilmore and @MattSinger. And you can follow the show @FilmSpottingSVU. That's where we announce the winner of each show's listener's choice and where we share more streaming suggestions from you, the SVU listeners. For Film Spotting SVU, I'm Allison Wilmore.
And I'm Matt Singer. Thanks for listening.